From a secret location somewhere in America, this is your Chill Pack
Hollywood.
Hollywood Hour.
I'm leaving.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Well, hello, Dean Haglund.
Hello, Phil Lairness. How are you?
It's not how am I, it's where am I. And I got to tell you, on this morning, Dean, I am about to explore the Bandera volcano and ice caves here near Grants, New Mexico.
That's crazy talk.
Yeah.
An ice cave and a volcano on the same day?
Not only same day, 50 yards down the road from each other.
So how does the ice cave stay cold and the volcano stay hot?
Indeed. Indeed. The ice caves never melt. They never get above 31 degree Fahrenheit year round. I'm going to be filming in both spots. And apropos of our guest you're going to be interviewing today, Stephen Elliott Altman.
Yes.
Who, as I understand it, is a sci-fi writer and a comic book. You were telling me about a graphic novel series that he wrote for Dark Horse.
Yeah, it's called the Baker Street Irregulars. Hilarious. Based on they actually got the rights from Arthur Conan Doyle's
estate
to take the original stories and then retell them through the Baker Street Irregulars, which were a series of street kids that Sherlock Holmes came to in two books, two of the novels.
That's
from the
awesome.
Original. Yeah, and so he takes those characters, makes them the main central characters, as if they're solving the crimes and then making Sherlock look good. You know,
fantastic.
Hilarious twist. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I also know that he's written a video game, has he not, for Ancient Aliens?
Yeah. This is what the whole thing is. Just launched a couple of weeks ago. I think we mentioned it there. But yeah, if you've been watching Ancient Aliens on History Channel
which I have not, as you know, and I would encourage people not to. But I want you to know that I, in honor of our guest.
Yeah.
And in honor of those who seem to want to tell a boring story about human history, that it was in some way influenced or involved aliens, I asked the proprietors here of the National Park whether there was any indication, any lore about aliens at any point visiting these very mystical, magical, mysterious, and dare I say, sacred sites that I'm about to explore.
Right.
And they said, yeah, there's no indication or evidence whatsoever of that. However, and once I got the however, of course, my ears perked up. They said, these are the most amazing sites in all of New Mexico and dare we say the Southwest. So if aliens ever did land, then you can be damn sure they visited here.
But now, isn't the bodies of those super large 8-foot skeleton, like their 30,000-year-old tribe that were all 7 to 8 feet tall
and there were the mound builders. No, do you know how much that we say of native tribes is not in fact unknown? But look, I mean, you of all people in the world of the conspiracy minded, to you know, there is a paper trail documenting how as long ago as our founding fathers, an effort was made to mask, to hide, to obfuscate what was known about the history of the native peoples, the ancient history of the native peoples, so that we could, and when I say we, I mean white guys, so that we could argue that it was all right what we were doing to the native peoples, because look, after all, they had done that to these previous beings that had been here instead of what we knew, which is that they were their ancestors and had just naturally evolved out of them. But anyway, this would all be great stuff to explore in a movie all about ancient mysteries, quite honestly.
Yeah, wouldn't it, though? That's why I thought this was a perfect time. Why not play a game?
Something called The Truth Is Out There, Ancient Mystery. That would be great. I should be shooting stuff for that right now, and you should be talking to a sci-fi novelist and comic book author about...
And game creator.
About what insight he gleans into our possible historic connection with aliens through the making of a video game.
Excellent. Well, let's talk to Stephen Elliott Altman then.
All right. And I'll see you, Dean Haglund, or talk to you next week.
I can't wait.
I've never been in Australia.
What?
I tried to come across the border, and they stopped me, and they said, have you ever been convicted of a serious crime like rape or murder? And I said, I didn't know you still needed that to get in here.
And they laughed.
They kicked me out.
Oh, yeah, totally. Awesome. Well, we'll start. This is the beginning of the interview then. How about that?
Okay.
Cool, man. Okay, so how far back do we go, you and I? This is...
I think we met at a Comic-Con back in like 2006 or 7.
No, it's earlier than that.
More than that? Well, that's a long time ago already, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, that is 10 years. Oh, dear Lord.
I feel like it's about somewhere about there. Maybe a little more than that. And we were actually introduced by Chase Masterson.
Were we?
Yes.
All right. That one.
You know why it's fuzzy? Is because I think we had had a couple of drinks.
Nonsense. What, a Comic-Con? That never happens there. What are you talking about?
It was good. And she introduced us. I was going to make a torrid joke.
She listens to the podcast, so, you
know. It would have been funny, but yeah. No. You know what it is? I just did an interview last night on Suicide Girls Radio.
Oh, yeah.
And anything goes on that show. I mean, we were talking about video games, and suddenly we were talking about alien sex, and then my PR girl, Amy, calls in, and they have a rule on Suicide Girls Radio. If you bring your phone with you into the studio and it rings, you have to answer it. You have to answer it on the radio.
Oh, fantastic.
So I saw Amy calling and I said, Amy, you're on Suicide Girls Radio. And they immediately dove in like, Amy, would you have alien sex? And she's like, what? But she started rolling with it. And she said, no, you know, I wouldn't. I'm married and I couldn't do that to my husband. And they said, well, if the human race's evolution depended on it. And they eventually got her to say, yeah.
Well, I would think human evolution depending on it, that sort of overcomes any morality to whatever you have to your relationship. No?
Her rationale was that if we didn't do it, that nothing else mattered. Her relationship would collapse. Everyone would be dead anyway. It was kind of like she saw it as if it was an all or nothing, of course I would.
Yeah, know? Yeah. I would think
she did preface it that she hoped that the alien looked like Ryan Gosling.
Now, what are the odds of that? Unfortunately, they're going to be, you know, the Pleiadians, the short guys with the bald head and the slimy skin.
Yeah, but don't you picture it? Like, maybe it's more like on, what was that movie? In Cocoon, was it? When they zipped out of the suit.
Oh, yeah.
Like their human suit, and then they were just light on the inside.
Right. One would hope that. Maybe they're so blinding. But, you know, there's so many alien species out there that we've learned about, or that I've learned about over the years, that it seems like, and, you know, that we all technically are alien-human hybrids in some capacity.
Now, you see, okay. Now, this brings up an interesting point, because I am a science fiction author, as you know. And so I've always been, you know, this is a fictitious world to me that I'm writing about, and I consider myself somewhat of a scientist.
Okay.
And so I'm coming at things, you know, rationally, and I've never really questioned, you know, I've always thought, you know, in the Carl Sagan kind of way, there's billions of stars out there. There must be, I mean, just mathematically and statistically, there must be other life forms. But I never really had to consider this until I started working on Ancient Aliens, the video game, for History and A&E, in which time I then watched, you know, 8 seasons of Ancient Aliens and began to really question everything. And, you know, I started out somewhat skeptical, and now coming out the other side, I'm really leaning towards the fact that I believe, you know, there is alien life out there, and that they have had a hand in our evolution, and further that our government knows things that they've, you know, kept from us for either, you know, devious intention or maybe just for public safety. And I'm curious about disclosure and finding out at least what does the government know. But right. you, so I'm coming to this, you know, this is new to me. And but you, because of your involvement, maybe it predates the X-Files, but at least during that time, it must have started you questioning this a lot earlier. And the people that you must have come in contact with over the course of your career must have really shaped your awareness of the situation. And I say that just because of what you just brought up to me moments ago.
Yeah.
When you started. So why don't you, you know, I'll interview you for a minute, Dean. Like, what do you think?
Well, you know, this is the thing. In fact, we did a documentary, Phil and I, called The Truth Is Out There, where he was amazed at how many people I had run into and met over the years. And going to conventions, of course, people come up and tell me all sorts of fantastical stories and really neat ideas. So, yeah, I met, like, you know, Jordan Maxwell and Dr. Roger Lear and Nick Pope and all those guys. We'd have fascinating conversations regarding, you know, I would be Mr. Skeptical. They would go, oh, yeah, you know, aliens. I go, oh, come on. I would say something like any guy who hadn't researched the topic would say, that's ridiculous. And then they would have a stack of papers and information and stuff they devoted their life to refute whatever ridiculous comment I made. So over the years, absolutely, there's some things that are quite compelling. I had, going back to alien-human hybrid, a talk with I guess he's a PhD biologist from Berkeley. And I said, you know, for me it's weird that humans can't retain vitamin C, something that's necessary for life, something that if you don't, you get scurvy. We just pass it through our system. We have to continually intake vitamin C. So from an amoeba, evolutionary, how would you evolve out the need to retain a vitamin that's necessary for life? That seemed to me that would be an indicator that there is some sort of alien genetic mutation in our system for us to always have to be eating oranges in order to survive. And he said, that's weird, sure, but not that weird because apparently gerbils or hamsters or something do that too. So I'm going, okay, well, then why would an alien then crossbreed with a hamster? That doesn't make much sense either.
Well, okay, so I've never thought about it this way, but so they say that where you live, in the geographic zone will provide the food and resources that you need to survive,
right,
or you wouldn't be there in the first place. For instance, citrus plants, you know, grow in Florida and California where there's a lot of sun.
Right.
So it suggests that you need to ingest vitamin C, you know, to sort of, you know, fight off that climate or coexist in that climate. Whereas like in New York, where I'm from, there are apple trees, but right, there aren't citrus trees. And so it suggests that there's vitamin C in an apple, but it suggests, you know, different things growing where you need them. So is what he was proposing the fact that we didn't take vitamin C might be that we were extraterrestrial and that we were not actually indigenous to this planet.
That's sort of what the indicator is.
But us and the hamster.
Yeah, us and the hamster.
Our closest relative.
I know. So he said because of the hamster, there is possibly an evolutionary marker in our own planetary life cycle in the 4.5 billion years. That's possible. What for him, he said, was weirder is our immune system. Because if you're a one-celled amoeba, you continually have to take in new cells in order to evolve. So then how do you develop a system that will suddenly fight cells and incoming information and attack it as opposed to sublimate it and evolve from that? So he thought the immune system being introduced to a thing was a weirder and more indicative indication of some alien cross mutation. I know. Fascinating, right?
Yeah.
So I'm sure you've seen then all of the ancient aliens when you're designing this game. Is there anything that, did you go out and research? Like, did you get to the Nazca lines or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, first off, this show does such an excellent job at introducing all these subjects. Now, they can only go so far in an hour of programming to delve into it, but they're excellent starting off points that would often leave me, you know, going to Wikipedia and seeing what went beyond to the Nazca lines. But what the game was really focused on was the time of Zaptepi and discrediting the archaeologists who thought that the pyramids were only 2,500 years old,
right,
and saying that these pyramids and the Sphinx, you know, far predate that, you know, with the Great Pyramid of Khufu being the last surviving wonders of the ancient world, that these far predated them, and that this was a time when humankind supposedly had not invented the wheel yet. How did they make these precision blocks and build this pyramid that we basically couldn't build today?
Right.
Engineers, so how did they do it? And so that there was scientific information either lost to a previous civilization of humans, or we had extraterrestrial help.
Right.
And so, you know, I've just been fascinated with all the topics there, but there are certain ones that I followed through further than others,
of course,
in my outside research. But I've read all of Sitchin's, you know, writings on the subject, and I'm fascinated by Van Daniken's writings on the subject, and just how I love his origin story. There's actually an episode of Ancient Aliens that's just about Van Daniken.
Oh, really?
How he came into studying this, and that he was. I hope I don't bastardize this. He was researching and translating the Bible from Latin,
right,
and he was reading passages that depicted, you know, it said God came down on his pedestal, and there was the sound, you know, the large grumbling, and he was reading these passages and saying, my God does not need to descend from the heavens on a platform.
Ah.
And there's no rumbling sounds. This sounds like a like technology.
Right.
That I'm listening to. It doesn't sound like, you know, so he started researching and finding all these passages that really sounded like this was, you know, primitive people just looking at a technology gap.
Right.
And reporting what they said. And it started to dawn on me that it seemed more rational, my old paradigm, you know, my old paradigm set aside, that these were flesh and blood aliens using advanced technology that would seem godlike, seems more feasible to me as a science, from my scientific perspective, faith aside, than there being magical creatures who could just do whatever they wanted at will, like, you know, the Greek gods that right. were out there, or the Egyptian gods. So that was how he came into this and started approaching it. And his thinking was rather revolutionary. And then he was pegging everything back to Sumerian texts,
right?
Our oldest form of writing,
yeah,
that was actually saying the people came down from the sky and gave us this technology, and they were here to mine gold. So I was like, whoa.
Wow.
And so our earliest text says this, and yet we seem to discredit it because we feel like we want to explain everything scientifically, and yet we also want to have this faith this faith-based culture where we just take everything for granted that it wasn't science. So I the answer has to at least be somewhere in the middle. There is some credibility to these things. Right?
Yeah. Are you watching the Pyramid Code on Netflix?
Yeah.
Now?
Yeah.
Have you seen that one with Graham Hancock and all that?
Yeah.
And explaining the 25,000 year cycle from Golden Age to Silver Age to where we are now. The Iron Age or the Dark Ages, as they as they referred to it,
or as Joss Whedon referred to Buffy the Vampire's time, which is basically our time, as the Light Ages.
Well, yes, yeah. And I'm always fascinated. My favorite, of course, is Ezekiel chapters 1-24, which he describes right off.
He goes
the top.
On a trip. He goes on a spaceship.
But at first there's two guys that come floating up at him, and they have wheels within wheels, which sound like helicopter blades or some sort of propulsion system. And he can only describe it in animal terms. So
their helmet, one side is a ram's horn and the other side is a sheep's head or something. Like, he has such trouble describing these things in his technology. But clearly, there's some sort of jet propulsion or something that is floating these guys towards him that he's writing about and never talks about it again. He never, like, goes, I wonder what that was. He just, the first 24 chapters is like, holy crap, just saw this weird thing.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And now the rest of it. Okay. So I think the Bible and all of those ancient writings are all littered with all of this kind of thing. And even that Egyptian hieroglyph that the piece
fell off. It looks like a helicopter.
It looks like a helicopter. And then beside the one, there's another, it looks like the Jetsons car, for crying out loud. So one's the helicopter, and then just to the lower right of it, the other one is a Jetsons car. And when they give tours, apparently now, they're told not to talk about it. Don't show that piece. So I'm like,
oh. Well, look, how about, and in Dendera Temple, they have what is clearly a light bulb.
Yeah.
You know, that's where they call them the Dendera bulbs. And the interesting thing about it, about the temple at Dendera that shows this light bulb, is it happens to be in a chamber that is deep underground where there was no light available, where they made these incredible paintings, and there's no torch soot.
Right.
Anywhere to be found. And with no torch soot, you have to say, well, how did they light this room to paint it? So it really does suggest that they had electricity back then. I mean, there's one of the things put back out by the ancient astronaut theorists that are on the show,
right,
is that mankind has had the level of technology that we have now or similar to it at different periods in time. And it keeps basically getting erased as we get wiped out, as we go through ice ages, that we've had this technology before, we've gotten here before. There are the name of the city is escaping me, where it truly seems as if there was a nuclear explosion. There's vitrification of the rock that's in line with what would happen if there had been a nuclear explosion. So does humankind just keep getting to the same level and then exterminating themselves?
Wow.
And then we build it all over again. And so we're really, it's happening again. Like, and this that, is, an, yeah.
Like that Tom Cruise movie, right? Live, Die, Repeat.
Live, Die, Repeat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just keep going through the same cycles.
Well, it's, the argument for it is, humankind does seem to have a something that's natural to us is to build things. You know, we've got the opposable thumbs and we build technology and the technology builds on itself. And then we, you know, we make computers and we make jets. We take over the air. We saw the moon and we said, how do we get there? And we got there. I mean, which is amazing, unless you're one of these people that believes we didn't get there.
Right.
And so there's something in our nature. I had an argument with somebody when I was a teenager about, you know, humans are natural. We're not doing natural things. And their counter argument was, no, this is natural to us. We do it. We're from Earth. We build things, and we blow ourselves up. This is just we're at the top of it. So maybe I hope there are aliens, because we probably need enough guidance to not self annihilate.
Well, this is an argument that I've heard a number of times. That 1968, there was DEFCON 1. All missile silos were opening up, and suddenly all systems failed. All at the same time, both in Russia and in North Dakota and South Dakota silos.
Here's an interesting one. North Korea just launched the first missile that was capable of going intercontinental, right?
Right.
And it failed. It went up and it came back down. What brought that down? Was it extraterrestrial? Was it American Star Wars? You know, do we have some kind of something? But I found it really interesting that missile didn't quite make it, you know?
Well, but as we see with Elon Musk and his project SpaceX, you know, rocket science is a science. It's pretty tricky to get something up there. So I could see that every missile launch not being successful isn't really in the realm of alien, as opposed to idiotic, you know.
Could be.
Yeah, but mathematical.
But a country that I see North Korea as an evil influence in the world. I mean, and that's just my judgment.
Right.
But that the fact that that level of country was about to launch a missile that could have hit us and it went down, I give a little more significance to it blowing up like that. So somebody was keeping them from getting. There's also, I just heard some conspiratorial theories that what just happened in Europe, that besides the terrorist attacks, that there was supposed to be some kind of a nuclear device exploded, but that it was countered by the forces of good somehow.
Oh.
So that didn't go off. I mean, I've heard tell in these circles that we're traveling in now. I feel like I've now entered the circles you're probably in.
Right.
That there is some planetary protection already in place that if somebody tried to ignite a weapon of that caliber, that it wouldn't work.
Ah, right.
It's already been defeated. Like the children are safe already.
Right.
It's not going to happen. And I sleep better at not thinking that.
Yeah, that would be, yeah, I would too, actually. I hadn't heard that. Now, with your game, does this come into play in this Ancient Aliens game?
That's you know what? I was thinking, because you're not doing, last night on Suicide Girls, we were able to show all these visuals, and I can't show them on your audio-only podcast.
Well, we can have a link, of course, to where everybody can find it, and we put that.
Well,
on
I figured, why don't I just if I just play it on my laptop here right now, you can hear it at least.
Yeah,
right?
Let's do that.
Let's do it. Okay, so here is the 30-second intro television spot for Ancient Aliens: The Game, which is going to start airing tomorrow, because it's Ancient Aliens is going into its ninth season, and the premiere for season 9 will be tomorrow.
Which is May.
And our TV. Which is May. Oh, that's right. We're in a different time zone. It is May 6th.
May 6th. Okay, awesome.
Ancient astronaut theorists contend that some extraterrestrials may have come to Earth in our remote past.
History presents.
Why don't we try to find out? Any volunteers?
Ancient Aliens, The Game.
How about you?
Travel back in time to abduct primitive humans, manipulate their DNA, and help build ancient civilizations. What if it were true? Ancient Aliens, The Game. Play today.
So I'm an alien. I'm going to Earth, and I'm doing like a Sims game where I'm injecting DNA and seeing what weird, mad laboratory creatures develop from my crazy DNA injections.
That's part of it. Yeah, that's part. So let me take you through a little bit.
Okay.
So I came into the project, and I saw what they were building already. They were building a it basically was like a Farmville, you know? You're building houses, but the difference is you're building houses and they sprout the DNA of your villagers and you harvest DNA. And and you have you're building the Great Pyramid of Khufu, right?
Yeah.
Behind you. And so you can see your villagers hauling blocks out of the limestone blocks of the quarry, and you're building the pyramid, and it takes a long time, and you really get a sense of, wow, this was a massive undertaking, because you get hundreds and hundreds of villagers as you progress through the game.
Right.
And so, and then you you abduct them and you probe them and you take their DNA and then you evolve them into minotaurs and then into savants, and you evolve them so they can carry bigger loads, just like Sitchin's theory that we were here to help them mine gold. And the idea being that you need gold to, well, let me take you back. So that's what they had, was this Farmville-like structure for the game.
Right.
And I came in to write the story and do the narrative design once they had that mechanic. And the first thing I said was, who am I playing this game? If I'm an alien, then I should know these things already. I don't need any instruction. So what I built around the story, and the second thing was I wanted Giorgio in the game, because Giorgio has sort of become the of all the ancient astronaut theorists on the show, that in their brilliance and each having their own point of view, and sometimes they disagree, by the way,
right?
On some of the theory, Giorgio has kind of become the figurehead of the show,
right?
If nothing else, because somebody decided to make a meme of him, you know, saying aliens, and I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens, and whatever, that helped the show really. He hit a tipping point, I think, in the collective consciousness about this important, you know, issue of whether aliens are coming. I think it helped the show a lot.
Yeah.
So I thought Giorgio should be in the game, and A&E was very open to that, and we went back to Prometheus, the production company that does the television show,
right?
And they helped us, you know, figure out how to make that happen, and were kind enough to lend him to us, and then we made his likeness, and then as you heard, we got him to do the audio recording of the script that I wrote. to get him in the game to help the fans of the show identify with the game. It's fun to have him in there.
Right.
But then you go, how is Giorgio back in ancient Egypt? You know, and why is he there? And I wanted to put a quest system, you know, into the story so you could go on these missions. So we created these characters. We have the Pharaoh, Neferkara, and we have Giorgio. So basically you come into the game, and it's not much of a spoiler because you get this in the introduction. You're basically – Giorgio is lecturing us in this kind of TED talk about ancient aliens at university in present time, and he asked for a volunteer from the audience that he's going to regress them back in time to the pyramids to find out how the pyramids were built and if there were aliens involved.
Ah.
And he picks you.
Right, yeah.
Because you're the player. And then he sends you back into ancient Egypt, and then you wake up in your body at that time.
Cool.
And then you know you're back there for a few moments, and then all of a sudden you get abducted by extraterrestrials, and then you're floating in the tank, and you meet a gray alien who says basically our homeworld Nibiru is in trouble, and we need gold to sustain our depleted atmosphere. Which was Sitchin's theory.
Right.
And in return, Earth is about to face a cataclysmic event. I love that word.
Cataclysmic.
Cataclysmic event.
Right.
And we're going to help defend your primitive people against it. Like, basically, humans are not very evolved at this point. We're going to help you defend against that in return. But you're not ready to help yet. We need to transform you. And they transform you. It's kind of a painful process you go through. And you become a hybrid.
Wow.
The reason I wanted you – and you've got four fingers instead of five. The reason I wanted you to become a hybrid was because then I believe there was some drama there because you're helping your humankind and you care about us, but you're also helping them. And it kind of puts you in the middle, which allowed for some dramatic situations, you know, between the interplay between the aliens and the humans.
Yeah, for sure.
While you're playing. So I layered that, you know, into the story and into a quest system there. Which I think enhanced the game a little bit. I'll leave it to the players and your fans who can come play the game.
Right.
To let us know if that story kind of worked. But I realized what I did then was I just took the show, which kind of posed the questions, and we had to move it into the what if category where we were really exploring, okay, now we're saying maybe they're aliens. We're saying there are aliens. Here they are.
You are
playing with them. And we are building the pyramid, not did they build the pyramid. So I kind of extended – that was my job, was to kind of – how do you take the show, which is an exciting show and mentally stimulating,
but speculation?
Not very. You don't really see that as a game. You can't really gamify that. So it was a necessary evolution to take the intellectual property into a game version.
Right, and make some assumptions that you may or may not be what they're saying in the show.
Right, right,
right. So, but you have to. So it sounds fun though. So then, as I'm playing,
I hope.
Do I have the choice then to evolve further with the aliens, or am I stuck now with limited alien human interaction?
Do you mean your villagers that you're, or you personally?
The player. Yeah.
We've only got chapter one in the game now, which is about it's somewhere around 40 quests that go in, and we actually have paused there at a cliffhanger. Before we start doing the second installment. And the second installment will begin with what happens to you in that situation. And I can't actually divulge what happens in the second piece. But let me just say that your question is addressed.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So who's building the game engine on this one? What's that company?
This is a company called Fifth Column, and they're up in San Francisco.
Oh, cool.
And so Fifth Column is the developer, and A&E, the A&E Network, is the publisher.
Right.
And the game airs on the History Channel. A&E is the parent company of the History Channel.
Wait, the game airs on the History
Channel? No, I mean the show airs on the History Channel.
Yeah.
And so the game is a history-branded show.
So I go to A&E to play this game?
You can click playancientaliens.com and it will take you to a landing page where you can play on Facebook.
Oh, yeah.
The Facebook. You can play on the Facebook.
The Facebook. Uh-huh.
You can play on the Facebook.
I heard
you. You can play on Android, either on an Android phone or on an Android tablet. And you can play on Apple products. You can play on an iPhone or you can play on an iPad.
Oh, that's so awesome.
And the fun thing is, if you sign in through Facebook, which is good because you can send – resources to your other friends who are playing socially,
right.
All of your devices sync up automatically. So if you're playing on Facebook and your houses are going to harvest DNA in an hour, then you might be, you know, out at, you know, you might be sitting in Comic-Con and in your booth, and you might look at, you know, just go on your phone, harvest your DNA, and then, you know, that's stored up when you come back. You know, it's kind of that mobile interweb interplay there.
I've heard of it. Well, that's fantastic. That sounds really fun, man.
Now here's the thing. What? We're not even live yet. So for your fans who are hearing this, we're still in beta until tomorrow. So your fans could hear this right now and say, wait, I don't want to wait till tomorrow when the game launches. I want to play right now. And they could go on Facebook to Ancient Aliens or into Ancient Aliens community, find the game, and it'll block you and say you need a password. And the password is – ready?
Ready.
The password is – Let's play Ancient Aliens.
Ah.
And they could play right now and go and
in
play.
Beta.
Or in beta, which is just funny because we're on the cusp, because tomorrow, knock wood, fingers crossed, we just go live across all platforms anyway.
Oh, wow.
So, but you know what? The funny thing is, because we're actually live in Australia right now because we beta tested in Australia. So anyone who's listening to you in Australia can play right now anyway,
except
without the password.
Yeah, it might be 24 hours before this gets up.
That's fine.
So
some people could be playing by the time they hear this podcast, and then I'm gonna listen to the podcast to get some secrets.
Right.
You know,
I'd like to point out there's 24 time zones around the world, so theoretically one of those time zones.
What do you mean around?
Around
it's flat.
Oh, we're going to that, are we? How about almond shaped. I heard that one. That's,
you know, Gene, when I'm talking to you, I always want to think about conspiracy stuff.
I know.
And so, like, you know what's interesting is to look at conspiracy theories that were actually proven true.
Right.
Like where you saw where one was a conspiracy theory and everyone said, nah, and I guess the world is flat is one of them.
Right.
You know, to start with.
But yeah, but like the CIA and the Bay of Pigs invasion and all of that Cuba stuff.
Well, what's your favorite? I guess my question for you is: what is your favorite conspiracy theory? And if you've got, and do you have one that was actually proven to have been true?
Well, let's see. The one I always go to as my favorite comedy line is JFK was a suicide. So that's hilarious. but which one has been proven true lately that I liked? Gosh, well, I always refer to the training of a bunch of in the School of the Americas off Costa Rica to go invade Cuba, and then that failed miserably. And then when you heard about that,
is that Jacob's Ladder?
No.
Remember the film Jacob's Ladder where they're training, and then that's not what they based.
That's apparently the same area where they train, but not in reference to the Cuba invasion. But then that, of course, all those papers came out and they said, oh yeah, we did that. And you're like, oh, so all those years you heard about that and everybody going, nah, that's crazy. We'd never
do that. It's all DARPA.
It's all DARPA. Oh yeah. Well, and I get my DARPA annual, brochure that tells me all the projects that are going on. And,
wait, so is this released from DARPA or is this?
No, that was released, through Freedom of Information Act, somebody investigating it and CIA said that, and you know, 40 years had passed and here's what we did. So I think that was just an investigative reporter. DARPA stuff is quite different. DARPA actually, the kind of the science public arm of the military, with a complete black budget operating, but they actually put out, a couple of things, sort of saying what's going on, but it's very vague, and a lot of it just ending with the word wet-wired, because so much of it now is brain-computer interface technology. And I met a mathematician who taught at USC, and he said, oh yeah, I just worked with this Russian mathematician, and we came up with a formula that won't be able to be proved for 1,000 years.
Whoa.
I know. You go, what? Well, at the current rate of computing and stuff like that, this thing that we came up with, this formula, its proof will take 1,000 years in the current scale of math progression. And then I said, well, who, what?
That, oh, my, that's dizzying. Because if you think about the exponential growth of technology and to say that it'll take 1,000 years, it seems, how would he even conceptualize that?
Well, this is one of the questions I had. I go, well, it's a lot of complicated math. That's why it took 2 PhDs.
He's got zero accountability for his job, you know.
Well, and I said, what now? Now, why did DARPA pay for this, and what are they going to use it for? And he goes, I have no idea. They said, here's some money. You two sit down and come up with something. And this is what we came up with. And they said, thank you, and walked away with it. Now,
that, you know, that brings up an interesting thing. And when agencies have different scientists and specialists, you know, working in separate rooms, not knowing what the project in its entirety is.
Yeah.
I mean, I just started watching I'm a little late watching Manhattan, you know, about the
Manhattan project. Yeah.
Yeah. The Manhattan project, the show where they don't all know what they're building. One person's building a propulsion system and one person's building a delivery system. And one person's, you know, hands on the, you know, what are the shock waves and it's amazing. Yeah. And then they have to, you know, put it together. Oh my God, we're building, you know, an atomic bomb.
Right. Right. And that no one person just sat there going, oh, I got an idea. How about this thing that, shoots plutonium at high speed and splits an atom, and then we use that as a nuclear fission system weapon? Like, somebody could conceptualize it, but to actually get everybody together, I could see why you would compartmentalize that, because somebody would go, I'm not doing that. So I assume that maybe this algorithm or a formula that's taken 1,000 years to prove would maybe be perhaps for something that you would go, yeah, you know what? I got a problem with that, so I'm not going to do it. So I assume that's why they always keep you in the dark about its full function.
Right, right, right.
You know, we were in, when we did the X-Files Expo, which was the convention run by Fox for just X-File fans, mm-hmm. And we did 10 cities. They wanted them in really cool, unusual spaces, not your convention halls, not pipe and curtain. It was going to be like awesome, like we were in the Tustin Air Base, you know, and all around. But when we were in Washington, D.C., we were at a decommissioned weapons testing facility, White Oaks Weapon Testing. And the guys who were setting up went all through the facility, and they said, oh, there was like a weird chamber that had blood on the inside, and some guy picked up a cassette tape, which they were planning out the 91 Iraq invasion, bunch of guys talking. And then I walk up and I see a whiteboard, and it has all these mathematical formulas on it.
Did you take a picture of that?
No, I didn't have a camera phone at the time. Oh. I know, it was what, 99, I guess that, or 2000? Anyway, it had all these massive amount of science, and then it just said equals neural disruption. I'm like, oh, look at the formula for a neural disrupting gun.
Oh man,
I know.
But you know what? If we had a talented person who could regress you and get that, you took a picture of that with your mind, right?
At
some point, it's that data is in you.
That's right. I could
You're now a target.
Oh, why did I tell that story? That was ridiculous. Oh, no. That was terrible.
Neural disruption. I mean, like that doesn't sound fatal, at least. It sounds like something. It sounds like my phaser is set to stun, doesn't
it? Exactly. I suddenly forgot why I'm, attacking this. Why am I in this war? Oh, yeah. You know. Gives you
It feels like you'd lay down your weapon,
right?
Or you'd fall. Maybe you just lose your. You just fall down like jelly.
Yeah,
you'd be like a jellyfish.
Oh yeah, you forget how to walk, sort of thing.
Or maybe like a flashbang.
Right.
When a flashbang goes off, you're neurally disrupted and you can't see or hear.
So I guess it has varying degrees. Like it goes from a slightly, French ennui, like melancholy. Why am I here? To oh my God, I can't actually operate my bowels. Somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's true.
In between there, that's your.
And nobody. No, but right there, that would work right there. If you're on the battlefield and all of a sudden you shit your pants, nobody wants. Nobody wants to keep fighting. Like you're like, I'm gonna back off. I'll be back.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'll be back. I'm a little wet.
Yeah. I could see that. How do we get here? I forget.
I like it.
I like it too.
I think somebody should work on that.
But yeah, like the brown note in South Park. Same idea. Hey, whatever happened? Now that we talked about this project currently, remember you were doing the Baker Street Irregulars?
Baker Street, yeah. We did a graphic novel.
Uh-huh.
Me and my writing partner, Michael Reeves, and a very talented artist named Bong Dazo, and we did the Irregulars for Dark Horse, and it was a graphic novel, and the premise was that these five street Arabs, excuse me, six street Arabs, I left one out. Right.
That helped Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, that are mentioned in two Sherlock Holmes stories in canon, would be the main characters, and that they would basically solve all the crimes that Holmes was on, and Holmes and Watson were in the background.
Love it. Yeah.
And so it was a kid's fantasy piece, and we did the graphic novel. It was successful, and Dark Horse decided not to run it as a series. We thought it was going to go forward. We made a deal with the Arthur Conan Doyle estate that we could use all the characters, we could tell all the stories that were in the canon, retell them all, as long as the kids were in the foreground and Holmes and Watson were in the background, and we could write new stories. And every now and again, a producer comes along and says, let's do this, and we get, you know, five steps in, and then for whatever reason, as it happens in Hollywood, some projects move forward, some projects don't move forward.
Ain't that true. So true. So then what's in the future for you now that you got this?
I actually, funny that you say that, because I kind of left the TV feature world and pitching things. I mean, I'm a science fiction author first, but when my stuff gets picked up, I'm usually, quite pleasantly granted the opportunity to take a first draft of the script.
Right.
And to be a producer and to move things along. And so I kind of left for a few years, and I worked at Acclaim, and I did games like Nine Dragons, and just for Wooga, I did a game called Pearl's Peril, which is one of the top games on Facebook right now.
Oh.
It's got like 30 million people are playing Pearl's Peril. It crossed the $100 million mark.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. So,
Thank you. Some of your fans out there may play Pearl's Peril, and they're going to go, this guy wrote this great girls game? Yes, I wrote that. Big on the Facebook.
Right.
And then it prompted... I did a couple other games, but that's why A&E came and sought me out to do Ancient Aliens. But funnily enough, I do actually have a television show that's in development that may move forward. And it's based on a novel that I wrote called Deprivers, which is a medical epidemic where if I have this fictitious disease called sensory deprivation syndrome, and then I touch you skin on skin and I'm a depriver, you're going to lose one of your senses. It could make you go blind or deaf or lose some memory or your balance or you can't smell things.
Right.
And different deprivers cause different sensory deprivations. And the story is basically about what happens when the world goes touch shy and we lose this basic thing that we take for granted every day, which is almost as essential to us as gravity, which is being able to touch other people.
Right.
You know, you have no idea how, handshake, a kiss goodbye, a kiss to your mate, hello. I mean, touching is important. They proved with the Rhesus monkeys experiments back in the 60s that if you do not have physical touch, you'll go insane.
Yeah.
Catherine Dunn, who wrote Geek Love, wrote an introduction to the book.
Oh, cool.
Where she discussed this. It wasn't to my book Deprivers. It was to the anthology The Touch, where 23 other sci-fi writers, all much more talented than I am, took my concept of Deprivers and wrote in my Deprivers universe, and it gave their own take on it and their own characters who caused different deprivations so that we could get a feeling of epidemic.
Oh, cool.
In other words, a voice, more voices than just my little voice. I had all them running. So Catherine Dunn wrote an introduction to that, and she talked about something very interesting that always has fascinated me. She said, adolescence, one of the reasons for insanity, the insanity that is adolescence, is the fact that you are at this point too old to sit on laps and yet too young to mate.
Oh.
It's a touch limbo. You're gawky, you got pimples, your body is developing, you got hair growing all over you in weird places, and you feel gross, and no one will touch you.
Ah.
And it's maddening, you know?
Wow, that is fascinating.
So she likened it to that, and she also told this little moment where she... It was during the AIDS crisis, and which is a whole conspiracy theory. We could get into a whole show on that.
Yeah, yeah.
But she saw a young news reporter who had a beautiful young wife and a newborn baby to be thinking about. And he was talking to an AIDS patient who reached out their hand to shake hands with them. And she could see him hesitate to shake the guy's hand. Like, could I catch this? How is it really transmitted? We don't know. Is it from mosquito bites? Is it by saliva?
Right.
That moment of hysteria when we didn't know. And so the guy reached his hand and almost wasn't going to shake his hand and then kind of caught himself and reached out and shook his hand. Like, he made a decision to make the human contact and risk it. But he was risking a lot if he didn't know what was going to cause it. So this show is basically about what happens when the world goes touch shy. And
goes crazy.
Yeah. So I wrote a spec pilot for your viewers out there. A spec pilot is when you weren't commissioned to write a pilot. You just did it on your own volition.
Right.
So based on my novel, Deprivers, I wrote a one-hour pilot. And it was picked up by this production company called Mar Vista.
Oh, and they're a big deal.
So Mar Vista's got it. And I think we just attached a showrunner to it. I can't say
the name. Wow. Look at you go.
And we're about to go out to the networks and see if the world of the television world is ready for this concept. It's really interesting because this project almost got greenlit and went 10 years ago. We actually, TBS had optioned it. And the show that it would have been then if it was done is very different than the show it would be now. Now we have Showtime and HBO, and we can be risque because a show like this is really about people we care about who have this medical condition, and when they get together, you know, okay, let me put it this way. When you see two people that you care about on screen that you've invested your time in about to kiss for the first time, there's an energy there.
Yeah.
You know, there's a tension of, are they going to do it? Are they going to get together? Are they going to kiss? Imagine it's two people you care about and they're about to kiss, but when they do, somebody's going to go blind.
Wow.
What are you willing to give up for a loved one?
Right.
It's basically the question. And so these people kind of can't have sex. And so it's all about sex. They can't, like, it's different degrees. Like, there's one character in the story who, if he touches you, you go deaf, but it's only for 6 hours.
Yeah.
And you can handle that.
Yeah.
She's like, absolutely. You can find a girl that could handle that, and you'd speak in sign language.
Yeah.
And you might even get a kind of a kick.
Yeah,
out of it.
Being deaf, it's nice and quiet for 6 hours.
Right, but if somebody's going to blind you permanently, that person's not getting touched by anyone, and they could become a criminal, or happens there?
The
POV character in the show, one of them is a paralyzer. He touches you, and you're paralyzed for only 15 minutes.
Wow.
And he uses it to do bank heists.
Oh, that's pretty good.
It's not a show about having superpowers. It's a show about having things that you just wouldn't want to have.
Yeah.
I have to explain that. I had to explain to production companies, like, you know, Heroes or that kind of show. You know, if somebody says you can fly, there's a room full of people and someone in the room can fly, no one's scared about that. Everybody wants to be that guy.
Right.
But if you're in a room full of people and somebody touches you and you go deaf for 6 hours, everybody's I don't know if I want to be that guy.
That sounds so good.
You know, so I said, this isn't a show about about powers. This is a show about kind of a curse, and it's not in an X-Men realm where it's fantasy. This could really happen, and what would I wanted it to be very gritty and realistic, and how would the world react if in a situation like that? So this is me trying to be like Rod Serling, right?
Yeah.
Rod Serling, he wanted to talk about, you know, about social mores, and did it by way of showing he couldn't talk about these things outright.
Right.
He had to kind of wrap them in a science fiction story, and then he could talk about them all he wanted, because it wasn't about how humans were terrifying humans. It was about how aliens were terrifying.
Exactly. Humans. Race of ugly people.
So instead of talking about the fear we have of SARS and contagion in a science fiction manner, I did it in a sci-fi way, but it's kind of what we call blue sky sci-fi.
Yeah.
Where you just add in this one little element and see how society would react. So this is a way of exploring human touch, you know, one of our base instincts that really never gets talked about. It's as quiet as, we don't talk about that gravity is here because we just deal with it every day.
Absolutely.
What would happen if that was taken away? And so for season 8, you know, of it running, we'll say, it will be cured of it. And then we'll say, okay, now what did we learn about human contact?
Right.
You know,
Well, awesome. Now, Deprivers, the book, that is that available anywhere? Can I?
Oh, yeah, That's so you can go on, you know, Amazon or Barnes & Noble into the bookstore and get Deprivers.
Awesome. And then they're going
to... The Touch is a little harder to find, the anthology where the other writers, you know, worked on it too. But I'm very proud of that one because we gave all the money from that to an AIDS and a charity, an AIDS charity and a cancer charity, and we raised like six figures for them.
Oh, wow. That's
and all these authors, yeah, all these authors gave their free time. You know, they got impregnated with my idea and wrote a great story and put it out there as, you know, for charity. And I got the idea to do that from watching Bob Geldof's Live Aid. You know, all these musicians got together and gave back. So I gave them my concept. And how I'll give back to the writers now, if the show goes, knock wood, is I'll get all of the writers who did their stories in The Touch to get at least story by credit if we can do an episode like their story in the show.
Ah, that's fantastic. Look at you,
Steve. I'd love to help give back that.
Look at you give back. That's awesome. Well, thanks.
You're so welcome.
This is so awesome. It's great catching up with you, too. I apologize. It's been how many? Well, no, it's only been a couple of years since the party.
Oh, I think it was about a year ago. Yeah, but you know what?
Yeah.
If you have to go out, Dean, and to see your old friends by getting them on the radio and talking to them from a distance, you know, I understand, and that's better than nothing.
Well, exactly, and you know, now you have a reason to fly to Sydney and hang out. So,
I've never been to Australia, so now I have a reason to come over there.
Absolutely, and you just expunge that criminal record of yours, and you should be fine.
All right. Well, thank you. This has been awesome. I hope everybody goes out and checks out Ancient Aliens, the game.
Yep.
Go to playancientaliens.com and play it on your Apple or on your Android, or come on Facebook. And I hope to see you in game. And I'm going to start blogging out there. My Twitter handle is @RealSteveAltman. And I'm going to give some cheats and tips and hacks in the game. Yeah, so that people can, you know, find some fun things in the game that they might not find otherwise.
Awesome.
Cool, If I don't see you before, Dean, are you going to be at San Diego Comic-Con?
I don't think I am this year because I'm doing a couple conventions here on the Australian side. So it totally overlaps the same time in San Diego.
What's a good Comic-Con convention in Australia? Because when I reblog you, I'll tell people to check this out.
Oh, well, there's AMC in Melbourne in October 17th. I'll definitely be at that one. There's Supernova Con in Sydney in June. I'm pretty sure I'm at that one. And then there's the Oz Comic-Con as well. I'm not sure the dates on that one, but they're in every city. So that's a big deal as well.
So, all right, well, cool.
Any one of those, man.
All right, well, I, you know, is there a place where people will put messages like on your blog and stuff like that?
Yeah. They all, they are, Chillpack Hollywood Hour is the name of the podcast that you're on. And you can go to Chillpack Hollywood.
Thank you, Chillpack Hollywood.
Yay! And and you can follow us at Dean and Phil, because that's the two of us. That's our Twitter.
All right, I'm going to throw you the links to the game in case anyone listening to this wants to find it that way. And I'm going to also send you the video clip of the TV spot. And then maybe
we'll
a dialogue starts there. I'll take a look at it. And if any of your fans have any questions for me, I'll be happy to answer them there.
Awesome. Thanks, Steve.
All right, Dean.
Talk to you soon, man.
Talk to you. Take it easy, brother.
Bye.
Bye.
Guests of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn.
In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.